you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Content warning. This episode contains discussion of violence and murder, including the murder of a child.
Leopold and Loeb are two names that will remain forever intertwined in the history of notable American crimes. Convicted murderers Nathan Leopold and Richard Loeb remain infamous to this day. But nearly a century ago, in May of 1924, both men seemed to have a lot going on for them, at least on the surface.
They were young. Leopold was 19 and Loeb was 18.
They were well educated. Leopold had graduated from the University of Chicago and was planning to attend law school. Loeb had earned his degree from the University of Michigan and was considering a graduate degree in history.
They were from two wealthy and influential Chicago families. Leopold's father, Nathan Sr., was a successful businessman. Loeb's father, Albert Henry Loeb, was an influential executive at Sears Roebuck and Company.
Then, on May 21st, 1924, Leopold and Loeb did the unthinkable. While prowling around in a rented automobile, they came across a boy named Robert, or Bobby, Franks. The Franks were another well-established family in Chicago. Bobby was even a distant cousin of Loeb's.
Leopold and Loeb lured the boy into the car. Then they proceeded to brutally murder him, clubbing him in the head with a chisel, and then suffocating him with a gag. Bobby Franks was only 14.
Their motive for that heinous crime was bizarre. In our view, that's the reason why this case is still discussed today. The two young men apparently wanted to commit the perfect crime. It didn't work out, though. Police caught them within days. As the two men discarded Bobby's body in a culvert, Leopold dropped a distinctive pair of glasses. That clue broke the case wide open. Both men confessed to the murder in short order. The only question left was what would become of these two privileged teenagers who killed a young boy so needlessly.
We started thinking about Leopold and Loeb recently because of an ongoing case we've also covered. We're talking, of course, about the murder of four undergraduate students at the University of Idaho.
There are a few interesting parallels. Both cases have attracted intense media coverage. The stakes for both are very high. The death penalty was on the table for Leopold and Loeb in 1920s Chicago. Idaho also still has the death penalty.
The accused in Idaho is Brian Koberger, a 28-year-old criminology PhD student. Koberger, of course, has not had his day in court yet, so he is presumed innocent until proven guilty. That being said, he also fits the mold of a well-educated young man pursuing a graduate degree. An impressive venture on the surface.
And if Koberger is convicted, then it appears that his plans may have unraveled in a manner that mirrors the downfall of Leopold and Loeb. In a probable cause affidavit for Koberger's arrest, authorities noted that they found a knife sheath with DNA on it, apparently dropped at the crime scene.
All of that made us want to know even more about Leopold and Loeb. We ended up getting a chance to speak with Simon Botts. He's been a professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice for 16 years. Back in 2008, Professor Botts published the book For the Thrill of It, Leopold Loeb and the Murder That Shocked Jazz Age Chicago. It's a comprehensive account of the case, with a special emphasis on the courtroom showdown between state's attorney Robert Crow and the widely celebrated defense attorney Clarence Darrow.
Our conversation with the professor delves into all of that, as well as the events leading up to the murder, the psychology of the killers, and how Darrow plotted a course to attempt to spare them from the gallows. My name is Anya Kane. I'm a journalist.
And I'm Kevin Greenlee. I'm an attorney.
We first connected while looking into the Burger Chef murders, an Indiana cold case. Together, we built a spreadsheet documenting hundreds of cases of restaurant-related homicides. That original spreadsheet gave way to our podcast, The Murder Sheet.
Now we maintain that same research-centric, investigative approach as we look into all sorts of homicides, including unsolved cases, historical crimes, and, of course, restaurant murders.
We don't just chat about the headlines. Our podcast is a platform for our journalism. The Murder Sheet focuses on investigative reporting, thoughtful analysis, thorough research, and in-depth interviews.
We're The Murder Sheet.
And this is Leopold and Loeb, a conversation with John Jay professor Simon Botts. You mentioned this in the book, that you sort of became somewhat interested in the Leopold and Loeb case after watching Alfred Hitchcock's film Rope, which of course is based on the Leopold and Loeb case. Can you speak a bit more to what prompted you to get so interested in it that you actually penned a book on it?
Yes, that's a great question. And as you say, I saw the movie Rope when I was actually in London. And I found it curious. I looked into it and I discovered that it was indirectly based upon the Leopold and Loeb story. And I was looking around for a suitable topic for the next book. And my interest in it was really aroused by the subject of the hearing in the courtroom. And my background is in the history of science. My PhD is in the history of science. And so I became interested in this legal case because of that. And what happens during, it's not a trial, right? There is no trial. There's no jury. The two defendants, Nathan Leopold and Richard Loeb, say they're guilty right as soon as the courtroom proceedings begin. So it's basically not a trial, but it's a hearing to determine punishment. Guilt is established, and so now what the lawyers are going into the courtroom is to appeal to the judge about the punishment that he is going to hand down to the two defendants. So what this is, Clarence Darrow, who is the defense attorney, he comes in and he brings psychiatrists in to say that the punishment should be life in prison, not the death penalty. The prosecuting attorney, the state's attorney, it's in Chicago, in the state of Illinois, it's called the state's attorney, not the district attorney. But the state's attorney comes in and says, no, he uses the testimony of psychiatrists also to say that the two defendants are knowingly guilty, that they knew what they were doing. There's no mitigation, there's no lessening of the penalty, and that the judge should impose the death penalty. And so the whole thing is about science. It's about the two sciences of psychiatry, which was very new to the United States at the time, and also endocrinology, which also was a fairly new science. it's a very unusual case because usually just one side brings in these kinds of expert witnesses, but both sides brought in a set of expert witnesses, psychiatrists and other scientists, to prove their point. And so from start to finish, it was all about science. And that was really what attracted me to the topic. And I kind of realized that nobody had really written an account before that knew very much about the science. And so previous authors have always kind of dismissed the science as not really having much meaning. Whereas in my book, what I try to say is that it was totally the science. And for the times, 1920s, it was very, very up-to-date science. These were the leading experts, not just the leading national experts, but the leading international experts in the history of psychiatry. And so that's basically the reason that I decided to write the book.
Today, and often in high-profile cases, you see a similar thing happen where you have dueling experts who, you know, it's basically squaring off before the judge or before a jury in trial cases. And it's whose expert is going to be more believable that will sway the case, essentially. And here you see a version of that, except, of course, it's not about guilt or innocence. It's merely about what do we do with these people who have confessed to such a horrible crime. Stepping back a little bit, if you could boil down the Leopold and Loeb case, just sort of the outlines of what happened, but also what level of impact and media attention this case generated in Jazz Age Chicago.
Well, that's a very big question, and I'll try my best to answer the different parts of that question. I'll start out with giving a summary of what actually happened, what the crime was. You have two students at the University of Chicago. Nathan Leopold is a law student, and Richard Loeb is doing a graduate degree in history. And so they're both together at the same university. They have known each other for quite a long time, and they have a relationship, a sexual relationship, and the relationship is very much dominated by Richard Loeb, who I think is the younger of the two by about 6 months. And Nathan Leopold is very submissive within the relationship. And it's really Loeb, Richard Loeb, who leads the relationship. And what happens is that they commit these originally small scale, I don't know what to call them. They didn't rise to the level of crimes, but acts of vandalism, like breaking into cars, smashing shop windows, those sorts of things. And then it gradually kind of escalated, and then they decided that they wanted to commit the perfect crime. And they decided that this perfect crime, so-called, would be the kidnapping of a young child. And so one day in 1924, they are looking for a young child. They spend the afternoon driving around the South Side district of Chicago where their families live. During that afternoon, they have trouble finding a child by himself or herself. But then they finally do see a young boy, 14 years old, called Bobby Franks. They invite him into their car. He's actually a cousin of Richard Loeb. And as soon as he enters the car, they kill him. And they kill him because he knows them. And so if they allow him to live, he's going to be able to identify them as the kidnappers once he talks to adults. So they kill him immediately. They drive out to a desolate spot outside Chicago, and they dispose of the body in a ditch. And nobody would ever have known about this crime. Nobody would ever have, they probably would not have even discovered the body. And it was purely by chance that someone came across it as he was walking home from work. And the police did find a pair of eyeglasses by the body in the ditch. And it was those eyeglasses that led the police to Nathan Leopold. And almost immediately, the two boys confessed to the crime, and one weekend in the office of the state's attorney, they gave the details in quite amazing detail, telling everything, how they did it and what they expected to get out of it.
Your book details the background of these two young men, and I mean, it's not understating it, I don't think, to say that they were from some of Chicago's more influential, wealthy families, it sounds like. Given all that, is it fair to say that this murder case quickly became a media sensation, essentially?
Yes, and really for two reasons. One is, first, as you said, the three people involved, that's the Leopold family, the Loeb family, and the Franks family. They all lived very near to each other, close to the University of Chicago. All three families are very wealthy, and they were well known, and particularly the Loeb family. And I don't say this in the book, but in fact, an uncle of Richard Loeb was a city official who had been trying to limit the activities of one of the unions, the labor unions, the teaching union. And the phrase, the Loeb rule, was very common in Chicago at the time in the 1910s. And then I'm a little bit hazy now on the details, but one of the two families, the father was a vice president of Sears Roebuck.
That was also Loeb. I was fascinated by that because I used to be a retail reporter myself. So I was like, that part was like tailor-made for me, and you went into a lot of great detail on it in the book. But basically, he was sort of in a position where he was a VP, but he was running the company. He was the power behind the throne, it sounded like.
Exactly, yes, yes. I mean, the owner, the head of Sears Roebuck was Rosenwald.
That was it.
Right. And he actually had he was no longer really involved with the firm. He was much more interested in philanthropy, and he was, looking to give his money away. And so it was the vice president who was really in charge of the store. So, the answer is these are three very wealthy families. And why was it such a sensation? And here's the reason ties in with the 1920s, the 19-teens and the 1920s. And what did people think of crime and criminals? And the persuasive belief at the time was that crime was something that only poor people, working class people did. It was almost like a genetic trait. A criminal would pass on his criminal gene to his children, and they would pass it on to their children. And so crime was something that was a phenomenon that was part of the working class or people who are even lower than the working class. So this crime, first of all, it's inexplicable, all right? Basically, you can't really explain it to say that they're doing it for the thrill of it. That's some kind of explanation, but not really a very satisfactory explanation. But it was, first of all, so astonishing to the overwhelming majority of people that these very well-educated, very smart, very intelligent, very wealthy people would commit a crime that seemed to make no sense whatsoever. And also was very, very brutal, to take a child and kill him right away in the way they did, in the kind of cold-blooded way, was really quite astonishing. So it was all those kinds of combinations of factors which made this a real sensation, not just in Chicago, but it was reported everywhere in the United States. It was a very, very big issue at the time.
The way Bobby Franks was killed, it was not any form of murder is going to be horrible, but it was not a shooting or something where there's distance,
right.
He was bludgeoned and then essentially smothered, it sounds like. So I'm curious, you mentioned earlier, they sort of confess right away, their families even after a period of denial kind of end up basically coming to the conclusion, like, they are guilty. We think they should be in a mental asylum. I want to jump back, though, to Leopold and Loeb themselves, because I think with your focus on the science and the psychiatry, you really painted interesting portraits of both of them, how people could, on the surface, seem like intelligent, successful young men, but be kind of harboring some disturbing fantasies. And you mentioned that Loeb was sort of the dominant party, but also seemingly the one who maybe seemed a bit more gregarious and charming on the surface, whereas Leopold was more arrogant and angry at the world. As you researched this, did anything surprise you about the characters of the two central figures?
Just the basic facts are very surprising. The fact that they had this sexual relationship, which at the time, of course, in the 1920s would have been very, very taboo. And I think what did surprise me about the research was that I was very, very lucky, very fortunate to have the sources that I eventually discovered. I remember I was living in Washington, D.C. at the time. And the psychiatrist, one of the psychiatrists for the defense, was actually the superintendent of St. Elizabeth's, which was the federal asylum run by the federal government in Washington, D.C. And I had a hunch that maybe there would be some of his papers in the National Archives. And the hunch turned out to be correct. And the first research trip I did was taking the metro down to the National Archives and going through his papers. And then in Johns Hopkins University in the medical school, they had the papers of other psychiatrists who were involved in the hearing. And these psychiatric reports paint a very, very detailed picture of both of the defendants, because both Loeb and Leopold, for the purpose of the defense, they are interviewed by the defense psychiatrists, and they tell everything about their childhood. And that evidence about their childhood is then used in the hearing in the courtroom. So that was the first astonishing thing that I found. Very unusual to find these psychiatric reports, which were very detailed. But then the next thing was that there was actually a transcript of the courtroom hearing. All right. Well, you have to think about the number of trials, hearings, whatever, legal proceedings, any time in the United States, there are just thousands upon thousands upon thousands of these hearings, and you can't possibly keep all the transcripts. You would need warehouses on top of warehouses to keep everything on paper. There's no internet in those days. And so usually everything is just trash. Usually a transcript is not even made unless there's some reason to make a transcript, such as an appeal. What I found was that the transcript of this courtroom hearing was at Northwestern University. Apparently, there was a professor at Northwestern at the time who had got his hands on a copy of the transcript, and it had been in his house for many, many years. And then when he passed away, he donated all his papers to the university, to Northwestern, and that's how the transcript of the hearing ended up at the university. So it was just amazing. And that was not something that I had anticipated or thought might be possible, but there it is. And that's how I was able to write the book, which includes so much detail, you know, nitty gritty detail. And because it all comes from those sources.
At the Murder Sheet, we're all about immersive audio experiences.
That's why we love Audible. An Audible subscription gives you access to thousands of audiobook titles. We especially enjoy their robust selection of mysteries, thrillers, and true crime.
I love Audible. I've really enjoyed listening to A Wicked Snow by Greg Olson. This story is all about a CSI investigator with a dark past and a terrible family secret. When I'm listening to Audible, it plunks me right down in the middle of the story. It's so spine-tingling that I can practically feel the cold air on my skin. Audible is your one-stop destination for thrillers and mysteries. Just be prepared to get spooked in the best possible way.
Listening to audiobooks offers a wonderful respite from the day. Audible allows you to listen on the go. I love taking a walk or a drive and just getting lost in a story. My favorite audiobook on Audible so far is Presumed Innocent, the book track edition. This classic legal thriller by Scott Turow is enhanced by a gripping musical soundtrack that amplifies the story's suspense and profound emotional beats.
As a new member, you can try out Audible for free for 30 days. This is such a valuable membership, and you get access to so many new listening experiences, including podcasts, Audible originals, and Audible exclusives like the Words Plus Music series.
Visit audible.com/MSheet or text MSheet to 500-500. A weight loss journey can feel like a lonely struggle, but it doesn't have to be.
For so many of us, lifestyle changes like deciding to lose weight, adopting a nutritious diet, and taking up fun exercises are all about putting our own health and wellness first. But it can be really hard to know where to begin. or how to keep the weight off once we've seen some progress. Quick fixes like soup diets and juice cleanses are unsustainable. There's a much better way to embark on this journey that over 200,000 people have already chosen. We're talking about the Ro Body program.
Here's how it works. Ro gives you access to one of the most popular weight loss shots on the market. Their Ro Body program then sets up a comprehensive weight loss program tailored to your specific lifestyle, health status, and goals. In addition to the weekly shot, you get one-on-one coaching with a registered nurse that can help you adopt and stick with lifestyle changes like exercise routines and nutritious diets. It's a comprehensive program that sees participants lose 15 to 20% of their weight in a year on average. But the real benefit is that you keep that weight off. This is weight loss at its most sustainable.
With Ro, the average weight loss is 15 to 20% of your weight in 1 year, in conjunction with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to ro.co/msheet. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. Go to ro.co/msheet. That's ro.co/msheet.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Yes, the book certainly feels like reading more of a novel because there's so many quotes, but these are direct quotes from those transcripts. And may I say, as people who've run up against destroyed documents many a time in researching historical cases, we definitely envy you and also commend your diligence when it comes to tracking those down.
Yes, yes, indeed.
So moving into kind of the legal proceedings here, you know, Clarence Darrow comes on the defense side of things, as we sort of previously mentioned. There's no question as to the guilt. They basically confess, and ultimately the legal proceedings boil down to, are they going to receive capital punishment, or are they going to receive some form of life? Can you speak to Clarence Darrow's and the defense team's approach when it came to using science to potentially save their lives, essentially? I mean, it seems like that was ultimately the mission at that point.
Yes, well, I mean, the case was already a sensation even before it went into court. And then going into the courtroom, it became even more a sensation because Clarence Darrow was involved. And by 1924, Darrow was even, we know him probably best for the Scopes trial, which was a trial in Tennessee. The Tennessee state legislature had outlawed the teaching of evolution in the school classrooms, and Darrow was the attorney who argued against the Tennessee law. But that was 1925, so that was after the Leopold and Loeb case. But Darrow, by 1924, had this kind of legendary reputation, even before he got involved with Leopold and Loeb, because he was very much a campaigner for free speech. He was very much a campaigner for labor unions, and he had been involved in many notorious cases of labor union activity. Probably the best known case was, I think, when some labor unionists in Los Angeles were accused of dynamiting the Los Angeles Times, the newspaper, the building, and Darrow was their defense attorney. And so he had just a huge reputation. I mean, there is no one now in 2023, even comparable to the reputation that Darrow had. He was a legend, but he's living in Chicago, and the Leopold and Loeb families come to him and they say, we'd like to have you defend our two boys, and we know they're guilty, they've confessed, but we want you to save them from the death penalty. And the death penalty in Illinois at that time was death by hanging. For Darrow, it was the perfect case because Darrow was somebody who, he was agnostic or atheist, whichever. He believed in determinism, which means that every single individual is determined by external forces. according to Darrow, there was really no such thing as free choice. All the things that happened to you in your life previous, they were acting on you to make you behave in this way or that way. And so he really had no free choice. And so he takes on this case, Leopold and Loeb, because he wants to bring this point of view, this philosophy, to a wider audience, which he does. And the way he does it is through using the psychiatry and the endocrinology. And Darrow is still a legendary figure in American jurisprudence. My guess is he's probably the best known lawyer in American history. And so he takes on this case. And then the following year, he has this second case, which is the Scopes trial, which is equally extraordinary and equally riveting. And so that's Clarence Darrow. And again, I've forgotten the second part of your question, so you have to remind me about that.
Oh, you're fine. I forgot about it too, but that's my that's my bad. Let's see. I would be interested in delving a little bit more into the kind of two prongs of the scientific approach to this case, endocrinology and psychiatry. And you mentioned in particular psychiatry being in sort of an early phase in the United States, at least at this point in time. And you detail this in the book in kind of a fascinating level of detail. But I mean, they're running all sorts of tests on these two defendants. Maybe you could speak to some of what they were looking for, how they were trying to use this science, but also I'd be very curious, you know, if we could discuss a little bit like how well some of this holds up in terms of our modern day understanding of this science.
Yeah, well, endocrinology is basically the action of the hormones on the human body. That's probably the best kind of capsule summary. But it was a very new science at the time. These new sciences tend to be kind of fashionable until they die out of fashion. 1916 is the establishment of something called the Society for the Study of Internal Secretion, which is basically endocrinologists getting together and forming their own specialized society. And then the next year, they establish a journal called Endocrinology. And what you see in the book is they're using these scientific instruments to determine the presence or absence of hormones in the body, according to the glands. All right. Now, I'm not an endocrinologist. I don't have any training or education in endocrinology. So I cannot tell you whether or not the science in 1924 is correct by our standard or not. And in a way, it's the same with the psychiatry. And historians of science actually avoid that kind of question, you know, because if you get into judging a science 100 years ago, according to what we now think in 2023, then almost inevitably you're going to find the science of 100 years ago somehow lacking or insufficient or just plain wrong according to our present day understanding. But, you know, 100 years from now in 2123, everything could change completely. And the people in 2021-23 could think that we, the people in 2023, were completely, completely wrong or whatever. So historians don't judge science according to present day standards. Psychiatry was also very new to the United States. The first acquaintance with psychiatry came, I think, in 1913. When Sigmund Freud came to the United States and he gave a series of lectures at Clark University. And those lectures were publicized and Freud's presence was noted. But I think one of the reasons that the psychiatrists in the Leopold and Loeb hearing were the most prestigious, the most well-educated, they were at the leading universities, and they were the leaders of the field internationally and nationally. They were in it because they saw an advantage for their discipline in getting publicity. But in fact, one of the things that did happen was that when you have two groups of expert witnesses, and one group is for the defense and one group is for the prosecution, what happens, of course, is that the two groups contradict each other. And so people say, well, what's going on here? You know, if these are scientists, scientists, and they're just getting on the witness stand and they're telling objective truth. And yet two groups of scientists, both equally qualified and both very prestigious, they're just saying the other group is wrong, all right? So what value can we give to science if both groups of scientists are just saying the other group is wrong? You know, I mean, where is objective truth? So it kind of brought psychiatry into a little bit of disrepute. That was one thing. The other thing is that when the final judgment of the presiding judge was announced, that caused a lot of controversy. And it was seen very much as people, the psychiatrists, going into the courtroom, pulling the wool over the eyes of everybody and getting this very controversial sentence. It's fascinating because you have two very young sciences. They're given this voice inside the courtroom and they make good use of it.
Before we kind of get into the final outcome, essentially, of how all this played out, one theme that kind of seemed to come up a few times that you sort of described in the book is the prosecution leaning on this, but also the press leaning on the fact that, like, Leopold and Loeb are so wealthy and prominent, and they have the best lawyer, they have the best experts, whatnot, and this idea that your average killer would not be getting such treatment, and that essentially they're buying an outcome. And on the other side, Clarence Darrow and the families indicating they're guilty, we know that, but they should, you know, have rights, and we're just trying to exercise that. And can you speak a bit about that tension?
Well, actually, that's very interesting because it works both ways. You know, that on the one hand, the state's attorney can say, look, you know, these two defendants are buying a defense. They're buying all these expert witnesses, which the average criminal couldn't do, right? They're buying the best lawyers, best scientists, best witnesses, and so on and so forth. And then they buy, by that means, they buy the sentence that they want. That's the state's attorney. But Darrow, on the other hand, made a counterargument, which was to say, hey, look, you know, if these boys had been poor, if nobody knew about them, the state's attorney wouldn't have put all his resources, he wouldn't have prosecuted it so energetically and so aggressively. This is all unfair because my defendants, my clients, Leopold and Loeb, are being targeted because they're wealthy. So it's an argument from both sides. I mean, we can get into the final sentence. The sentence, of course, is it was a life sentence, life plus 99 years, so they avoided the death penalty. But then what I thought was really extraordinary was the state's attorney, a member of the staff of the state's attorney, I don't think it was Robert Crow who was the state's attorney, but it was another person, spoke at the end, and he listed all these criminals who were more or less the same age as Leopold and Loeb, who had done various crimes, and they had received the death penalty. And so it's just fascinating to see how this all works out in the courtroom and how both sides are going for the sentence they want to get, and then they're using all the possible resources to get what they want, and they're going at it full tilt.
And yeah, let's go into the final outcome and maybe some of the factors that influenced the judge's final decision in handing down life instead of death.
Yes, well, it was extremely controversial, you know, because, of course, neither Leopold nor Loeb expressed any remorse. It did seem to be a brutal, cold-blooded crime. And the judge, when he came to give his sentence right at the end, I think the sentencing was actually on the radio. I don't think that the hearing was not on the radio, but I do think the sentencing the last day was transmitted on the radio. And my memory is that the whole of Chicago stopped what it was doing to listen to the sentence. And in fact, in his summation, the judge, very ironic, he essentially disregarded the scientific evidence, the scientific testimony, and said that the age of the defendants, the fact that one is 18, one is 19, it's not appropriate to give them death by hanging because they are so young. You know, there was a lot of pressure on that judge, Cavalli, to give the death penalty, and you can perhaps commend him for doing what he thought was right, whether or not you agree with the sentence, but he gave the judgment that he thought was correct. the state's attorney during the trial had only indirectly referred to the possible sexual relationship between the two boys. But then after the sentencing, he did make it more obvious when he spoke to the press. He was very, very upset with the result. He felt that it was a personal defeat for him. They were sentenced to life plus 99 years. The reason, as I remember it, is that if it's just a life sentence, then that actually can turn out to be shorter, quite a short sentence. By giving them 99 years, that ensures that they have at least 33 years, that it would be difficult for them to get parole very quickly. And they both end up at the Joliet State Penitentiary, which is some way out. It's in the middle of the state. It's some way away from Chicago. And it's a very unpleasant place. It's still, the building still exists. And I went there probably about 12 or 15 years ago. And when I went there, I didn't go inside, of course, but I went on the outside, and the building looks exactly the same, except it's virtually completely covered by razor wire up and down the walls. So it was still a prison at that time. I don't think it's a prison now. I can't be sure about that. But after a few years, both Leopold and Loeb were then transferred to a new prison. It's called Statesville. And that was based on a circular design, which, when you look at a photograph, seems quite reasonable. You know, what you have is the cells are all around in a circle, 360 degrees, I think four stories up and down, and there's a guard tower in the center. Well, this all looks fine on a photograph, but the reality is terrible because, you know, all the prisoners can look out and see each other. They all have this view, a 360 degree view, and they have a view of the guard tower as well. So it's actually a very threatening environment for the guards, because if something were to happen, if there was somehow a breakout, you know, they're right in the center of this circle. And in fact, what they did when they built that prison was to have the central tower could disappear down into the ground, so that if somehow all these cell doors opened, the guards would not be at the mercy of these hundreds, maybe even, I don't know if it was thousands, but certainly hundreds of prisoners. But the other problem with this design was the noise. I mean, you've got to think about hundreds and hundreds of prisoners. They can all see each other. And the other problem, of course, was that this encouraged a sense of solidarity among the prisoners, which you don't have when you have the old-style prison with just a row of cells. So it was a terrible, terrible design. But anyway, Leopold and Loeb got transferred to that prison after a few years in the Joliet Penitentiary.
And then, of course, very different outcomes for both Loeb and Leopold.
Yeah.
Loeb getting murdered in jail. And then Leopold actually was able to eventually secure his release, essentially.
And both of the prisoners were getting money from their relatives. And that gave them certain ability to bribe guards, to give money to other prisoners. And apparently Loeb was in the shower with another prisoner. And there's the other prisoner, the second prisoner, claimed that Loeb had advanced on him sexually in the shower. This other prisoner pulls out a knife and stabs Loeb to death, I think 47 times. And that prisoner is then put on trial for the murder, but of course he's not convicted because nobody else is willing to testify against him. None of the other prisoners will testify. They even want to testify against him. So Richard Loeb dies in Statesville. And Nathan Leopold, he applies for parole. He's denied initially, but he creates this image of himself. There's a lot of things about Leopold that keep getting repeated, which are all completely false and are self-evidently false. I mean, there's this business about him speaking lots of languages, you know, like you'll read, probably on the internet, you can read Leopold knew 21 languages, all right, or 37 languages. And of course, such a statement is ridiculous because, you know, he was in his 20s, 30s, it's simply not credible. And the way and what he did, what Leopold did, was create an image of himself. So he works in the hospital ward in the prison. He participates in a scientific experiment. Then eventually, I think it's 1957, he does get parole. And his efforts, again, to keep making this image of himself. And there was even one college at one time that was going to give Leopold an honorary degree sometime, I think, in the late 1950s or 1960s. And this was not given because there was kind of an uproar. But he eventually moved to Puerto Rico. He couldn't live in Chicago because his notoriety was too intense. He moved to Puerto Rico. He met a woman in Puerto Rico, got married, and I think died in 1967. So that was the end of the story for the two, for Loeb and Leopold.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Given how Leopold had such a issue with the truth and was so accustomed to creating these kind of versions of himself to impress people. And also, I guess I'm struck by, in his efforts to secure his release, not a lot about like the 14-year-old they killed. I guess, like, how sincere do you think that sense of remorse was? Or was that, can we just assume that's another facade to get what he wants?
Yeah, it's really impossible to answer that question. Yeah. Because, you know, he's going to go into the parole hearing and he's obviously going to express as much remorse as possible. You know, he did try to say that Loeb was the mastermind and he had merely been following Loeb. But did he really feel remorse? It's difficult to say. I mean, I can't say one way or the other.
Yeah, that's fair. We can't get into his mind as much as the various psychiatrists attempted to. In terms of how this case has sort of impacted society, I mean, one thing that I always kind of stress to listeners today is, like, oftentimes true crime or interesting crime has been couched as like a modern phenomenon. And while this, like, that's, you know, certainly is a modern phenomenon, it's not really new. Americans have always been obsessed with crime. But, you know, how has this case in particular, in your view, impacted our collective understanding of crime and perhaps like so-called thrill killings?
I think one interesting question is why, you know, there are many, many, many infamous, ghastly, ghastly crimes that have been committed in American history. And there are just a few that retain their notoriety down the decades. It's not quite clear to me why this happens with some crimes and not with others. I think one thing about this is the presence of Darrow, you know, the fact that he took on this case, that's important. I think that the fact that Hitchcock made a movie based on it, the fact that Leopold lived for quite a while afterwards and he got his publicity, you know, if they had been both executed in 1924, then perhaps we wouldn't have so much memory. But what happened, I think, was that because Leopold lived for so long, and then along come the movies, and there was a book written in the early 1960s, The Candle Keeps Alight. You know, we don't kind of forget about it. I always hesitate to say what impact it might make on us in 2023. I think it's a piece of history rather than that it has any impact or any meaning for us now. You know, that would be what I would say about it. I think what's been curious to me, I thought when my book was published back in 2008, I thought, well, that's it. That's the definitive history and nothing more will be written about it. Now, how wrong I was, because for some reason, and I don't think it had anything to do with my book, but for some reason, there's just been a ton of books. It's very curious to me because when I write a book, I'm very involved, almost obsessed with what I'm doing. And then as soon as the book is published, it's almost like, you know, my interest evaporates and I move on to the next subject. So I haven't read any of the books that have been published recently. It's curious to me to see this. And so it still has its appeal for a lot of people, for a lot of authors. And who knows, but there might be another movie made after it.
Certainly. People often tend to assume crimes are more interesting than they really are. When you see people speculating about crime online, oftentimes they interject a level of maybe it's a serial killer or a thrill killer, things that are comparably rare into the discussion quicker. And I almost feel like this is not because of Leopold and Loeb, but perhaps crimes like that have maybe warped our sense of what crime really looks like, because the media tends to spotlight the most outrageous or interesting or surprising crimes, that it kind of gives the public the wrong idea when, if we look at most murders, it's mundane things like a robbery, drugs, personal disputes, as opposed to, you know, kind of let's pretend like we're criminal geniuses and do something really heinous for no reason, essentially.
Right. And I think one of the things that, you know, present day 2023, we have so many now streaming services, so many programs out there looking for content. And so a lot of the content that we get has to do with crime, perhaps because it is sensational and you can build programs around it. But, you know, we have so much out there nowadays.
Absolutely. You know, but when people say that it's a modern phenomenon, I just want to be like, look at a 1920s newspaper.
Right.
I mean, obviously, your book is so comprehensive. There's so much that we didn't get to. But I feel like we got a very good overview of the case and also the importance of science to the legal maneuvering. Is there anything or any points that we didn't get to that you think it's really important for people to understand this historical event?
I think one thing we haven't talked about, which I think was impressive to me, was the character of Robert Crow. And this is the leading law enforcement officer in Cook County. I think it was just Cook County, which is Chicago. And I mean, when you read the transcript, and I think I can say the same thing about Darrow, both of them were extremely clever. I mean, extremely knowledgeable, very, very well versed in the law. And one of the things when I first started doing this, one of the things that I remember thinking about was the fact that when Robert Crow interviews Loeb and then Leopold, and he interviews them separately, and then he brings them together in the same room, and he asks one of the boys to start telling about the crime, which he does in detail. And then he says to the other boy, why don't you make some notes? Because that would help you recall. And if the one boy says something wrong, you can go back to your notes. And of course, what he's doing there is actually Crow is intent on getting those notes afterwards, which he does. And they're in the handwriting. And he does this with both boys. And they're in their handwriting. So that's, again, evidence that he can take into the courtroom and use against them if it's necessary. And the other thing, of course, is that the families were so sure that neither Leopold nor Loeb had anything to do with the crime that they waited a few days. They just said, well, the state's attorney will investigate and he'll find out that neither one had anything to do with the crime. So why should we get a lawyer? you know, and he had the whole weekend, state attorney had the whole weekend to talk to Leopold and Loeb. So it was really, they had no, once they had all given their confessions, which are very detailed confessions, you know, there was nothing else for them to do but plead guilty. So I devoted a whole chapter to Crowe, to Robert Crowe, because I thought that would be necessary in the same way that I devoted a whole chapter to Clarence Darrow, and both of them were very significant figures in this whole story.
Yeah, I was surprised that Crowe did not have as much of, I mean, Clarence Darrow, as you mentioned, went on to the Scopes Monkey trial, which just kind of propelled him further into the collective consciousness of American history, essentially. But Crowe, it sounds like kind of, crime went up, he was blamed for it. There was that whole bizarre incident with his deputy McSwiggin getting murdered at a seedy bar while hanging out with Irish gangsters. It seems like he kind of has been forgotten as a result of some of that.
Yes, well, I mean, he's an elected official, you know, so you've got to win election as state attorney, which I guess is every 4 years or so. So he had a short run, but he was a very, very good official. He took his job very, very seriously, and I hope that comes across in the book.
You know, if you kind of just look at the basic facts of the case and you say, okay, Clarence Darrow, and it was a really heinous crime, but they got life instead of death penalty, it might be easy to assume, well, like they were outmatched, but it really, they were very much adversaries. It was not a, it was not a foregone conclusion that they were going to get life just because Clarence Darrow came in.
Right, right.
I think that came across, just more for my own curiosity. You don't think he was corrupt? I know that was sort of the implication of the kind of how things went with his career, with some people claiming that because of his deputy's death, but you think it was
probably— Yeah, again, there's really no way to know it unless you would go into the detail. I mean, one of the things I think is law enforcement, in a sense, has to have some kind of relationship with the criminal underworld, and that enables them to get information. So perhaps that's what was going on, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting, though. This has been great. We really appreciate you taking the time and sort of speaking on these topics with us. Anything else that you wanted to mention? Or
no, I think we've covered everything. I mean, it's been a good hour. Very enjoyable talking to you, and I'm glad you liked the book.
Thanks very much to Professor Botts for taking the time to share his experience with us. Check out his book. It's available in plenty of websites online, and it's a great read. We'll include a link in our show notes.
Thanks so much for listening to The Murder Sheet. If you have a tip concerning one of the cases we cover, please email us at murdersheet@gmail.com. If you have actionable information about an unsolved crime, please report it to the appropriate authorities.
If you're interested in joining our Patreon, that's available at www.patreon.com/murdersheet. If you want to tip us a bit of money for records requests, you can do so at www.buymeacoffee.com/murdersheet. We very much appreciate any support.
Special thanks to Kevin Tyler Greenlee, who composed the music for The Murder Sheet, and who you can find on the web at kevintg.com.
If you're looking to talk with other listeners about a case we've covered, you can join the Murder Sheet discussion group on Facebook. We mostly focus our time on research and reporting, so we're not on social media much. We do try to check our email account, but we ask for patience as we often receive a lot of messages. Thanks again for listening.